Welcome to this class on October 28th, 2010. Review. We're dealing with that section resolution. Big deal. The significant image was the serpent wrapping itself around Jung, and then Jung's head becoming the head of a lion. And I think somewhere I put it in here. There. That's the front piece of his book, Ion, and then there's God Ion. So, as I mentioned, I thought it was the beginning of the historical basis of Jungian psychology. Then we started with Vanderpost. Saying pretty much what I felt, that's kind of why I brought it in. The anima was blind. Two women helped him. That we can discuss a little bit. Did two women help him, or was one woman part of the problem, I guess you might say? We'll continue with Vanderpost, but questions were raised about the crystals.
I looked up the pages where that was mentioned.
Good. So did I.
Okay.
What did you find?
I found 245, it's first mentioned.
Let me write see, did I find that? I don't think I found that. No. Okay, 245.
Then 247.
247 I found.
248.
248.
252.
Right.
254.
Right. I didn't find 245. Let's see.
It's the same. He speaks of it as the stone. It's in Elijah's house. It's on the right-hand column.
I don't have it. I cut it up.
Oh,
so
you cut it out. Here it is.
And I don't have 245 with me.
I see. He says, we are in a high hall with glittering walls. This is Elijah's house. As I look into, let's see, a bright stone, the color of water, lies in the background. As I look into its reflections, the images of Eve, the tree, the serpent appear to me. And this is how he talks about it. He calls it all, different times he calls it the stone and he calls it the crystal. And it always gives him images. Remember, he looks into it and sees the multitudes and the city destroyed in one of his last glimpses into this stone slash crystal. That's the first place I found it.
The crystal
besides in the cave.
Right. Okay.
The cave is that 247 reference, I believe.
Is that, let's see, the cave is prior to this, is that right?
I think
prior to 245?
After.
Isn't it
247.
Where he, the scene with the dragonfly type image, is that what we're talking about with the cave and the crystal?
That one.
Hmm. No, that's prior to this. The first picture that we dealt with, that he's in a cave, then he goes behind the crystal and into the...
Yeah, that's this one. I think that's what he talked about, 247.
247.
I thought that was called Descent into Hell. The luminous red stone on 237?
Yeah, 237.
237?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. It's way back.
Remember? Yes, I am way off, sorry.
Sent into hell.
I am way off.
And then the second paragraph there, he talks about...
So it's 237 also.
Luminous red stone.
There we go.
Which I reached. And he moved behind the stone.
That's
that one.
And and later the same stone seems to be...
And he equates it, too, with the sun.
Okay, so the stone becomes that sun.
I think so. That was your question.
Together later.
Okay,
I think.
There.
Yeah.
Remember that?
Yeah. And that makes sense.
The point is, I think they're all the same.
Right.
It took me a while to figure that out. I think
they seem to be the same.
That's because
he speaks of them as being having the same function.
Yeah.
Being most of the time in Elijah's house.
Okay. Good.
Let's just draw the line for a second. Yeah.
Okay.
Keep in mind those snakes.
Okay.
We're going to see more of them. You had mentioned, Kathy, that they were fertilizing.
It looked to me like they were fertilizing.
I think you're right.
Mm-hmm.
But I can't remember. What did we say when we did it the first time?
We talked about, somebody mentioned evil forces.
And somehow
dark.
Trying to destroy the sun.
Well, the arrows component, if you are too into ideas, turns into the snake or destructive. It's destructive aspect. That's how we talk about it.
That's how we talked about it.
Well, if you think of Medusa and her hair of snakes, and the idea of hair being thoughts.
Well, keep all that in mind, because I think that's not incorrect.
Okay.
But we're going to see more of it, I believe. And I just wanted to point out that I thought all the references to the stone and the sun were the same. But it took me a while to convince myself of that.
And the underworld sun.
And the underworld sun. Yeah, I should have said references to the crystal and the underworld sun are the same. I don't think it's the same as the daylight sun.
Okay. So this is the light and the dark.
Well, it's the light in the darkness.
Right.
And we'll say more about that. I just wanted to point it out.
Appreciate that.
Okay, so where are we then? We'll pick up. Vanderpost. And I'm on page 172. We've got the main idea. Again, the reason I brought it, I just thought it was a nice confirmation of what I had thought. And I wasn't sure about it. So, but we're going to fine-tune it down the road. So just to hear some of the stuff he said. As for Toni Wolff, the woman, the last paragraph on 172. See where I am?
Mm-hmm.
Who was to be his companion? She was a great and rare spirit, one of the few patricians, and certainly the truest in Jung's immediate company of collaborators. She had a courage and vision of conduct, perhaps alien to the Swiss, the high Swiss, and the international bourgeoisie who surrounded Jung. I just picked up a couple of passages to talk about her. 174, fourth line. When I first met her, I remember thinking in the primitive way natural to me that they were eyes capable of seeing in the dark. I always thought of her instinctively, and I had some knowledge to confirm the instinct, as the human equivalent of the porcupine who in the mythology of my native desert was the daughter-in-law of the god hero, a Stone Age Ariadne, married to a son who was, for Stone Age man, the rainbow element in the sky. Skip a little bit. The porcupine had large sensitive eyes that could see through the dark. That's what she could do for Jung, help him see what was going on in this dark period. As he says a little bit below there, Toni Wolff was both porcupine and Ariadne to him. See where I am there.
Is he equating Jung with Dionysus here, or liked it because of the Ariadne. How is he using that? Theseus?
I think it's Theseus.
Okay.
Remember that story? The thread out of the labyrinth? That's what Ariadne did. Yeah. You might just say a guide. Topic 174. As a result, on that day when Jung decided to let himself drop, she was the only one capable of understanding out of her own experience and transfiguration what Jung was taking upon himself. This world of the unconscious, which he was entering as a man, she had already inhabited and endured as a woman, and thanks to Jung's guidance, had reemerged an enlarged and reintegrated personality. And that third paragraph on 175, about halfway down, I believe that of all those closest to Jung, she suffered most. She was by nature too proud to complain, and in any case found more than reward enough in the meaning she gained in being Jung's most intimate companion and guide during those long protracted years of his critical and at times, psychologically speaking, most dangerous moments of his encounter with the blind Salome forces of his own collective unconscious. Tony, a little bit further down in the last paragraph, 175, she was in the grip of a great distress. I doubt whether any man is capable of fully comprehending what she was called to endure, let alone of measuring her achievement. I have a feeling that it needs a woman aware of the burden of projection of man's own blind and demanding feminine self, which her sex has had to carry throughout the ages, to do her justice in this regard. And I think just a nice summing up. 177. at the end of the second paragraph, Emma Jung, well, start with the second paragraph on 177. And finally, and most conclusive of all, there was the testimony of Emma Jung herself, great spirit that she was. Just before she died, she told a friend of mine, close to both herself and her husband, I shall always be grateful to Tony for doing for my husband what I or anyone else could not have done for him at a most critical time. This gap, the silence then, is the guiding and the bridging that was Tony Wolf in Jung's hour of trial and peril, the most significant outside aid that brought him to a total emancipation from the negations personified by a blind Solomon. We can talk about that question later. Just one more thing. Can I skip over it? Maybe we did it last week. Where he says, okay, Jung, here you go. Did we read that last week? I can't believe I skipped over that. Maybe we did that last week.
I also liked on 179 where he talks about through this whole process, they were all creating a new way for a man and a woman to relate up there on, because I felt like they were redefining what real love is.
Yeah, I like that.
And he says, a greater relationship between man and woman, a complete renewal of their attitudes to one another, promises, whatever the confusion and agony of the present moment, a richer partnership for the human spirit than any life has ever seen. Do you see that on 179, at the bottom of the first paragraph? At the top, on 179.
At the top of 179.
Yeah. Just that last sentence.
Yeah. It is not right. I agree. It may be a terribly historically blind comment, but
I think for the first time, men and women can really relate to each other. Thanks to Jung. That's my two cents.
And of course, the culture certainly has been moving in that direction. There was one other, I don't remember whether we did it or I skipped over it, where just Vanderpoel says, well, Jung, here you go. I just like that.
I remember reading that.
Did we?
I did too, yeah.
Well, you know what I'm talking about.
But oh, there, it's on 158.
Well, I guess we already did it then.
The second. Oh, yeah. The first whole paragraph.
Oh, well, Jung, here you go.
That's what Jung said to himself.
Yeah. Probably just that tone of voice.
That's what it feels like. Everything's...
Yeah. And he didn't have anybody to catch him.
Yeah.
Okay, then we go back to the text, 252. Salome looks in rapture. See where I am, 252, the second paragraph at the bottom. The light that streams from the prophet. So she can see and he turns into a burst of light. The serpent wraps itself around her foot as if paralyzed. Salome kneels before the light in wonderstruck devotion. Tears fall from my eyes and I hurry out into the night like one who has no part in the glory of the mystery. My feet do not touch the ground of the earth, and it is as if I were melting into the air. So her seeing, I think, is the resolution of his eros clouding his judgment. And the light we're going to keep our eye on today. It's insight, of course.
Well, this takes place underground, isn't that correct? So this is that sun. Is this the sun in the darkness transforming?
Yes.
Okay.
But let's watch what it turns into.
Okay.
So it's the crystal now becoming understanding.
You're equating Elijah's light and the crystal.
Yeah. I think it's the transform crystal. I think, didn't we talk about the snakes as... eroticism supporting this process. Do I remember that?
That makes sense.
Yeah. Well, there's more to it. The reason I'm going back to it, there's a whole lot more to it. But I just kind of wanted to review what we've said about it. Well, this next paragraph isn't so important, but it does set the stage for the following paragraph, so I wanted to look at it. My longing led me up to the overbright day, whose light is the opposite to the dark space of forethink. Well, that's kind of what we'll be looking at today. The dark space of forethinking. The opposite principle is, as I think I understand it, heavenly love, the mother. The darkness that surrounds forethinking appears to be due to the fact that it is invisible in the interior and takes place in the depths. It's also depressing and negative and brutal.
To the ego, or?
I'd say even to life.
To life, okay.
Well, how then is this forethinking, this image, it's an image-making process, how are you separating it out then into positive and negative aspects of this image-making process?
Yeah, hold that question, because we're going to get there. And I think we see thoughts in the later part of this chapter which are an example of the dark space of forethinking. And there's, if you really think about them, they are very dark. So I'm just sort of setting the stage to really dwell on that question. And I think this is why he had to wrestle with pleasure and forethinking, because one is depressing and the other is enlivening. Pleasure is enlivening. Forethinking is depressing. And cold. We'll be heading more in that direction, so those statements should make sense by the time we're done. The rightness of love seems to come from the fact that love is visible life in action. My pleasure was forethinking, had its merry garden there. Surrounded by darkness and night, I climbed down to my pleasure but ascended to my love. Now, none of this makes sense on the face of it now, but hopefully it will, which is why I'm looking at it. That pleasure is tied to love. And forethinking is a very strange kind of love. You might always say it's tough love, and that's my paraphrasing it, but
it's, they were opposites.
What's that?
The forethinking and the pleasure.
Well, but he's struggling to overcome their opposition. So they work together. Well,
could we just define what he means by love here? I mean, that just seems like,
I think what will help us, because I was sort of going to wait till we got there, but okay, let's jump ahead. We won't do the whole thing, but let's just hear what I think are some of the dark spaces around forethinking, what love might be, and so look at page 254. Second paragraph, fourth line. If you do not succeed in producing the greatest evil out of this war, you will never learn the violent deed and learn to overcome fighting what lies outside you. That's a horrible statement. So he's saying, war, get worse, so that we can learn. It may be true, but it's horrible. You would never say that in public. Oh, let's hope more kids get killed in the Middle East. Then maybe we'll learn. That's what he's really saying. And then the next one's even worse. Therefore, it is good if you want this greatest evil with your whole heart. Again, a horrible thought. But that's what forethinking is saying. That we can't hold Jung responsible for those thoughts. That's what he's hearing from forethinking. I think that's the darkness that he's talking about. It is brutal, heartless, cruel. Question is it true? That's the problem.
Is what true?
What's being said here?
I agree that it's horrible, but I don't find it that odd because, if you read the Psalms or the Book of Proverbs before we got Christianity, they're all about, dear God, save me from my enemies, cut out their tongues, wrap them in worms, send them down to the depths because I know you're in my favor. And there is no sense of, and you should, Christians are taught that, well, how do we know God should be in all our favor? Mm-hmm. The Hebrews said, no, actually, the God I want is in my favor. And I want God to do very, very awful things to the people who are not nice to me. And I think that's a much more honest.
Yeah, but if the world thought like that, we'd blow ourselves up in 2 days. It's simply untenable thinking.
It is, but it's honest thinking. I think that when we're out driving and somebody cuts us off, there's a flash of, I hope they wreck, mm-hmm. or I wish that I could just rear-end them. And thankfully, it does pass.
Now, see, that's the point, that it does pass. And I think that's what he's wrestling with pleasure. So that he can add another ingredient to that thought so that it doesn't live itself out. In other words, what I get out of this is a voice in the collective unconscious that is behind the war. Something in the human being is saying just this, and that's why we have war. It's partly true, as you say, but it's also untenable, and that's what he's struggling with. That's why he had to go the route of pleasure, to temper that. Does this voice sound like anything you know?
Sounds like Zarathustra.
It's exactly Zarathustra.
Yeah.
That's Zarathustra's voice.
And Zarathustra doesn't care.
Right.
He's very cold.
Right.
He's just here to bring a new way, and he doesn't care how that happens.
Right. Yeah. Exactly. So when Jung talks about the darkness of forethought and so on, I think that we see that, and I think those thoughts are the snakes around the sun. That they are really dangerous thoughts, which Jung is simply hearing. And if he were a psychopath, he would identify with him. So he's struggling with his eros to not identify with the thoughts, but hear them. And then, in his psychology, to find a way to address them.
I was wondering whether or not this is like a primordial, I can't think of the word, like the beginning of life. Tigers and zebras and,
Yeah, I see what you're saying, yeah. Yeah, it's a primordial thought.
And they're just doing what they need to do there.
Mm-hmm. The problem is if we do what we need to do with nuclear weapons that can blow up the world 79 times, then we're in big trouble.
Yeah.
That's the difference.
There is an interesting turn here at the end. Learn to overcome fighting what lies outside you.
Yes.
And that is a basic, that's at the end of that sentence, Gary.
No.
That is a basic idea of Jungian psychology is to find those things inside yourself.
Right.
And to fight those. Those are the things that you have to do battle with instead of what is out there, but we project it all outside ourselves.
But still, he's saying war is the way you will get to that state.
Right, by killing off everything on the in the outer world.
Yeah, or by seeing, finally suffering over how destructive you are.
Yeah.
If you are unconscious. But with the added comment, and that's a good thing.
But if that were going to work, human beings would be a lot more conscious than they are, because we've had war after war after war throughout history. There's been lots of killing and horrible things that have happened, and we have not learned from that. Right?
Yes. So the question is this wrong, or are we that stupid that we haven't heard? I'm afraid it's the latter.
I do too.
Is the purpose of war then to kill the hero? Is it to kill Siegfried?
Well, in this passage at least, I understand it to say it's to bring us to such despair that we finally turn to ourselves.
And then at the end, he connects this with the mystery of Christ.
Yeah. I just want to, we'll get here, look at it more closely,
okay,
but
right.
I just kind of wanted to give you guys some flesh on this idea of the darkness of forethought. And I thought that was an example.
So that is he saying that when you get to this point, you have to have some relief, and so the relief is either going to come through erotic love, or it's going to come through violence, but one way or another, you have to get it. So he's choosing erotic love to get the release that he's feeling in the collective unconscious.
I don't think it's release. This is how I put it. Given that this could be true, again, it's not his opinion, it's the voice of a dynamism that is shaping history. So in other words, it's the archetype behind war. He's just taking dictation. Certainly, if you subscribe to it, I think you could only be a psychopath. If you deny it, you're naive and you allow evil to run its course. But I think what Jung does now, he steps back from the statement and he says, okay, how can I address it? And Jungian psychology is an attempt to address that statement. Where here, it's saying war is a good thing. I don't think Jung personally would ever say that. But he's heard that there is something in us that's saying that. And that something in us loves to see problems outside. So Jung develops his concept of projection. So his concept of projection is a way to understand the gravity of that statement without identifying with it, and on the other hand, avoid the danger of Pollyannish. Human nature is good. That's my sense, anyway.
It sounds like he has developed projection, the idea at this point, the way he's speaking here.
Yes, I think he probably has. Well, he would have gotten it from Freud, but if he didn't have it first himself. But he certainly is extending his understanding of projection as having...
Because they're different, somewhat different.
Somewhat different, but the idea being that you externalize what you can't stand in yourself. And Jung, I think, would just add to it and say, and that can be a collective content as well as a personal content. I don't think he disagrees with Freud on the basic nature of projection. That is an externalization of something you can't stand within yourself.
Gary, when we first started talking about
forethinking.
Yeah.
Were we speaking of Elijah as forethinking?
Yeah.
Salome?
Yeah.
As pleasure.
Yeah.
So when he originally went down into this area, he was repulsed by Salome, pleasure. He was intrigued by Elijah, and now he has come to where he is more comfortable with Salome, who is now not blind, and he has seen the dark side of forethinking.
Right.
So that was a... What is
it, in Antiodromia.
Yeah.
But I think, you see, this, I feel this paragraph is sort of retrograde, that Elijah has become light, these statements have become humanized. That's why he needed the Eros to understand that horror, but not identify with it or not deny it, not go under, but then say, okay, given this is human nature, how can I respond? And for that he needed Eros. And he doesn't respond directly, he responds indirectly by creating his psychology.
And that would be love?
And that's love.
The creation.
That he gave enough of a hoot,
okay,
to create an attempt to deal with that statement, either identifying with it nor denying it. That's my sense.
Okay.
As we saw with Nietzsche, he simply identified with it.
Mm-hmm.
And if you can swallow that much, he completely presents the opposite of this standpoint at the end of his life. In what work? Answer the joke. There he says, we are not responsible for the evil. So I think he was working his entire life on this issue. And that's part of the love. And that answer to Job and this form a polarity that belong together. You are responsible and you're not responsible.
You're responsible for what? How you act in the face of evil? Is that what answered to Job?
Well, I'm still trying to figure that out.
Okay.
I would say there are certain circumstances where this is true, and there are certain circumstances where it isn't true. Go ahead. Yeah.
Could it be said that you have a responsibility to be in relationship with
it? Well...
Because what turns...
Yeah, it's a question of how do you define what that relationship is.
What turns God in answer to Job is the fact that Job questions him.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, that's the key, isn't it? I mean,
he's not questioning.
To be conscious and question. What, that idea of questioning the spirit,
yeah,
whether they are of God, in other words, is this aspect of the spirit, this image that's coming to me, meaningful, or is it...
Exactly.
You know, from chaos, and you know, von Franz talks about that as images coming from the self or from
mm-hmm.
complex.
Mm-hmm.
And I suppose if you're speaking in terms of the collective, it is from not simply a complex, but what would you call it? A historical complex or
the dark side of God.
Just the dark side of God, right?
Mm-hmm.
Which is basically the collective definition.
Mm-hmm. So I don't know if I've made that clear or not, but that you get this horrible statement. You can identify with it, you can deny it. He responds to it by creating Jungian psychology, which is an attempt to find our evil inside us, so that we don't have to have war to do that. Here it says, you do have to have war to do that. And so what he adds is, no, you don't. You can do it without war.
But at that period, they had to do it without war. Because
that's what this voice is saying, and it's probably true. Yes.
And the other thing, then, he goes back to it later still and says, wait a minute, it's more complicated. There are times when you have to confront this greatest evil, not as something that brings consciousness, but as something that you have to stand against.
You know, in one of Mary Woodman's takes, she's giving the example of how on the television there's some horrible thing about the starving children or stuff, and we're sitting there eating our dinner, and how we can do that.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we're still doing it.
It's not going to help them if you starve too.
Huh?
I said it's not going to help them if you starve too.
Yeah, I know. I don't know how to resolve that. I just know that I realized that. The people in the meeting and the Christians.
Well, Jung, I think, does try to answer that question. And his answer, whether you like it or not, is fulfill your own meaning. That's his answer. If your meaning is helping starving people in Africa, then go to Africa. If your meaning is working on some other issue, that's what you do. And that's his attempt to address, to answer that.
That's also what Mother Teresa said. I mean, there were always people who wanted to come to Calcutta, and there were people who even wanted to move to Calcutta to help with her work, and her answer to them was always, go find your own Calcutta.
Yeah. Okay, well, I wanted to jump ahead because I felt we were just getting lost in abstractions with these peculiar thoughts of, you know, the darkness of dark space of forward thinking, the love, the light. The light would be a point of view which successfully addresses that awful statement that we need war to wake up. The realm of love, middle of first paragraph on 253. The realm of love is light. The realm of forethinking is dark. Hopefully now, if you have that example, it might make it a little easier to grasp. Both principles have separated themselves strictly and are even hostile to one another and have taken on the form of serpents. So I think what he's feeling is really creative thinking is loving and truthful. But for whatever reason, we have separated it into loving on one hand and truthful on the other. So that loving has become compulsive and truthfulness has become mean.
At this point, would Jung have been aware that the left side of the brain controls the right side of the body?
I don't think so, but I don't know for sure.
But I just found it interesting that left historically is for evil things and right is for good things. And
no, that he would have known for sure.
And night is typically considered bad and day is considered good. But here he says left is day, right is night. And so that's intriguing to me because the right brain is also the more creative.
Right. I just don't know, Tammy. What? I don't think they had done that brain research at that time, but I couldn't say for sure.
But this is a comment about those two snakes, the black and the white, that fight each other, and then the white becomes partially black and the black becomes partially white. And that's why he's talking about they both took on the form of serpents that opposed each other, and they battled that out.
Right.
And then left became day and right became night. So it brought lightness into the night and darkness into the day. Correct?
Yep.
there's another sentence that I just saw. For thinking the singleness, love is togetherness.
Oh, where is that?
Middle of that paragraph on the left-hand side of 253.
The first paragraph?
The first full paragraph.
Oh, we haven't gotten there yet.
Oh, that's why. Okay.
We are little hedgehogs sauntering along. Oh, look at that comma. Look at that footnote. Speaking of footnotes, I think we haven't missed anything. No. So, at that time, we'll go to that paragraph. The loving light was annihilated and blood began to pour out, referring to the war. So, it's a little bit like Elijah, on the one hand, is truth. On the other hand, he is war. You follow that? Why he's war? Because he's saying, you need to be destroyed in order to stop blaming everybody.
Say that again.
Elijah has essentially said in that what we did just a minute ago, going ahead, that I forget what I did say. Elijah is the one that's saying war is a good thing. Prior to his becoming light.
So we're in Elijah, are we getting... Well, we've gotten both aspects of the Spirit through Elijah.
Yeah.
Are we not?
So in other words, again, it's the moral ambivalence of the unconscious, I think. War, you need war so you wake up. War is a good thing so you guys will wake up. That's what Elijah's saying. Of course, in the face of it, that's the impulse to war. People didn't say that, but this drive to war is a consequence of that inner collective voice. At the same time, if you can begin to reflect on that, it's also, on the one hand, true and very valuable. But when people identified with that point of view of Elijah, they just went to war. Jung, however, said, oh, look, this guy is trying to get us to go to war. He doesn't say it here, but I think he says it in the bulk of his work. Do we want to go to war? See how he brings the ego in. And as soon as he does that, then it turns into a burst of light. Because then you realize, my God, there's something in us trying to create war. So the same content can either lead to destruction or to insight, depending on whether you deal with it or not. Those crazy Germans, and probably us too, just were moved by that. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm.
It's terribly ambivalent, but... Now, going to the projection bit, the spirit of the depths wants the struggle to be understood as a conflict in every man's own nature. But now, a page later, this is a second paragraph, Barb, second sentence. But just a paragraph, or a page later, he's going to be saying, hey, and that's a good thing, folks. Buy your war bonds today. Since after the death of our... this is probably... not all that new, but I wanted to go through the dark side of Elijah and then how Jung feels that has become such an issue today. Since after the death of the hero, our urge to live could no longer imitate anything. And therefore it went into the depths of every man and executed the terrible conflict, excited the terrible conflict between the powers of the depths. So that the emergence of Elijah's darkness follows because of the projection of the hero energizing the unconscious. Remember, Nietzsche and the death of God, same idea.
So if the hero is dead, like God is dead, then the hero falls on each one of us.
And activates all of this examined passion. for destruction. And again, I think the rest of us now, we're familiar with. Forethinking is singleness. Love is togetherness. There was no togetherness in that statement. You need war to wake up. War is a good thing. Imagine telling the Jews, 6 million of you died so we could wake up. What a horrible thing. You've lost all possibility of community. But love is, okay, now do we take that truth and develop a creative attitude toward it so we can live together? That would be the togetherness. Both need one another and yet they kill one another. That's if the two principles, Salome and Elijah, are not lived with, particularly Salome. Since men do not know that the conflict occurs inside themselves, they go mad. One lays blame on the other. It is one half of mankind's at fault. Then every man is half at fault, but he does not see the fault is in his own soul, which is, however, the source of the outer disaster. And so on. That's nothing new. But I kind of wanted to look at, step by step, how he got there. That's a mouthful. Now it's nothing so terribly new, but knowing what lies behind it, namely this struggle between Salome and Elijah, I think adds some depth to it. So things that are not probably that new. As a man, you are part of mankind, and therefore you have a share in the whole of mankind, as if you were the whole of mankind.
I'm sorry if this is a silly question, but I just wanted to clarify when Jung talks about then every man is half at fault, he means humanity, right? Not men. Okay. Sometimes I get confused because he talks about feminine when other people in this time don't, and thank you.
Yeah, it's a little, because I don't know what the German is, I would imagine the German is Mensch, which we translate as man, but Mensch in German doesn't necessarily mean masculine, it means people.
Okay.
Part of this we get into translation complications. I think we got the basic idea, so it's just repeated, but in another image. Therefore, my next paragraph, therefore my forethinking in the principle of the Heavenly Mother becomes an ugly dwarf who lives in a dark cave like an unborn in the womb. The ugly dwarf, I understand as the ugliness of that thought we just dealt with about war is good. That's an ugly thought.
Yeah, this was a killer dwarf.
Yes, yeah. And that, finally I understand why it was in reference to Wagner. Because those thoughts are, on the one hand, true, and on the other hand, poisonous. So Jung accepts the truth of them, but then silently says, so how can we overcome this truth, where the naive person hears it as a truth and lives it? Fourth thing appears to you there as a dwarfish cleverness, false and of the night. Just as the Heavenly Mother appears to me down there as Salome. So love started as Salome. forethinking, which can ultimately lead to a very insightful view of life, starts ugly and poisonous and in a dark space. Do you see why he's going this route?
No, I'm not
going to guess. I'm guessing, of course, but I think he's trying to start with where we are. And we live in our emotions. And so you go, oh my God, I shouldn't have that thought. I shouldn't have the thought that war is good because it wakes people up. So you repress it. Jung didn't repress it. And what he finds, if he stays with it, is that it changes. The same thing with the two women. He's thinking, oh my God, he shouldn't do that. But he did it, and he stayed with it, and it changed of its own accord into a love of humanity. So these higher things start in a lower form. And to really have energy in the higher thing, you've got to start in the lower form. Does that make sense? Start with the instinct. So he's always starting with his instinct.
It's, I guess what I'm hearing is that Eros isn't, well, I know it's not just about sex, it's about energy, life energy.
It's about life energy, but it starts with sex. That's what he's having to face. If I want to get Eros, I've got to start with sex.
And sex is, the intention of it is to procreate.
Yeah, I would say how about the intention of it is to create, and the way it's lived out in most people is simply making a family. But he's realizing there's a type of love that wants to be creative for the whole of humankind. Produce spiritual children, you might say. But he can only get to the love through the lust. He can only get to the insight through the dark thoughts. Because each one is a transformation of its earlier stage. That's what gives it its power. See, forethinking appears to you there as a dwarfish cleverness. He doesn't say it is a dwarfish cleverness. Mm-hmm. But its first manifestation is false and of the night. So he's just evaluating the statement that's going to come later that war is a good thing. That is false and of the night. Although it's true. Humanly, it's false. Literally, it's true. Is this making sense? It's you have to work on like three levels in your brain at the same time. I think that's what's so hard about it.
Does it have to be sex? I know for Jung it is, but if it for somebody else, if it was I don't know, mink or ice cream or you know, if it gave you that.
Who's to say? I would say yes. But to be fair, but I think generally it's either lust or hate.
Okay.
It's either one of the two. Or, yeah, strong pull towards or a strong push away.
You know, one of the things I've noticed in my own journey is that I've been tired most of my life, but when I am actually able to be angry, which is not very often, I have all this energy.
Mm-hmm.
So I mean, that it's a good thing if I could be angry.
And you know, the way Jung would work with that then is, you know, he tries to give those emotions images. His issue isn't anger; it's sex. So that's Salome. But you know, if your issue is
issue is anger, he would then look for an image that symbolizes that anger. And just like Salome has transformed, he feels if you honestly acknowledge that emotion in time, it will transform. But again, you're starting with the urge, the instinct, the emotion at a base level. Let's take a stretch.